For our blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service brings you... The Indie Week. I'm John Federson, and I'm reading the current issue, dated August the 12th, 2021. Now, last week's theme music did not feature the twang of the Jaws harp, and will continue, actually, this feature today with another well-known percussion instrument. Now, those of you doing research into subatomic particles probably have several cloud chamber bowls around your garage, but did you know that by disconnecting them from your atom smashers and hanging them up, they make a number of pleasing sounds, which, by the way, are not included in our theme music today. So, go out there and check those cloud chamber bowls out, those of you that own a set. And now we'll get on with our issue of Indie Week today. So we'll begin with the op-ed column. This is a response to last week's article in Indie Week concerning Duke University Press, whose employees are investigating opening and starting a union for the university press, which they enumerated several reasons to have that. And now Mr. George Black is a data administration analyst there at Duke University Press, and he writes a response. I'm writing on behalf of the staff members opposed to unionization at the Duke University Press. And that was the article, employees at Duke University Press want a union. So Duke hired a law union-busting firm. The majority of our staff, including the managers, oppose unionization for DUP. The campaign phase of the current unionization effort has concluded, and we're now awaiting the results of an extremely close election among eligible voters, with an uncertain outcome. Currently, there are 35 union-eligible employees at DUP who want a union and 36 who do not want one. I'm one of the workers who doesn't want a union. In this world right now, where moral purity is expected of anyone who doesn't want to be publicly excoriated, you can't speak publicly and have an honest conversation about this misguided union campaign. Unfortunately, this means that all media covering the union is only hearing one side. Here are some things that the public doesn't know about the Duke University Press Workers Union that may help understanding of both sides. The union organizers, from the beginning, have focused their strategy on damaging the press and are misrepresenting facts. For many of us who have worked many years at DUP, this is heartbreaking and unacceptable. I've worked my entire career to reach a place with the benefits that Duke provides. I don't want anything to happen to that. I also have direct experience with the News Guild in my past career, and the experience was horrendous. These union organizing efforts began before our director arrived at the press in June of 2019. We have made tremendous progress since then in improving workplace climate, which I believe is a key reason that our publishing program has experienced unprecedented success in the face of a global pandemic. We've just completed two of the most successful years in the 100-year history of the press. I don't want to see that momentum slowed, or our relationship with the university damaged because of a union. My union colleagues continue to misrepresent everything that is happening. In their latest misrepresentation, they have stated that Duke University objected to the election because of a video glitch during the vote count. The truth is that there are multiple objections. The primary objection is that the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, forgot to put postage on the original ballots, had to send out new ballots with postage, and then created a shortened schedule, which meant that a couple of ballots might not have arrived on time. in an election that is basically tied, this is a crucial mistake. Two union backers left the press in July. One retired and one took a much higher level job at another press. And the union knows that a recount may result in a loss. They're desperate to find another way to win right now, aside from a fair election process. The DUP, Workers' Union, continually states that unions exist at other university presses. In fact, no other university press has a union. Yes, there are unionized workers at other presses, but those workers belong to university-wide unions. Harvard employs clerical workers who belong to the Harvard Clerical and Technical Workers Union. This was established almost 30 years ago. When all 5,000 clerical and technical workers at Harvard bargain for better wages, they have power. Similarly, there are unionized workers at Wayne State University Press who belong to two separate university-wide unions. The press is a small department of the university. It would be like the workers within the history department unionizing. It's a shortcut to hard organizing work across an organization, and it's entirely misguided because such a union will lack power. Duke employs 43,000 workers. Why should 35 workers within one department get better benefits than all other union workers? There is a reason that there is substantial opposition to DUP Workers Union from eligible employees. I hope your reporting does justice to the full picture. So far, media accounts have failed to do so and have simply reproduced misleading union propaganda. Here is how I calculated these numbers. 35 official pro-union official votes, plus 2 votes Duke challenged, presumably pro-union, 37. 2 pro-union employees who left the press in July, 35. So that's a total of 35 pro. 32 annual anti-union official votes plus 4 votes that the union challenged, presumably anti-union, equals 36. Note, 3 new employees who just joined DUP were not here for the vote, so we do not know if they support a union. All right. Tomasi McDonald and Jane Porter combined for this Gone Viral. Courtney Barton, a registered medical assistant, wore her mask Sunday afternoon while doing laundry with her 14-year-old at the Wash House at Lakewood Shopping Center in West Durham. Barton, who is fully vaccinated, said she heard about Durham's new state of emergency, but says, "But I never stopped wearing a mask even after I was fully vaccinated." And she offered a backhanded compliment for the Durham leader's decision to mask up in the face of the Delta threat. "People who are supposed to be leaders aren't leaders when it comes to what we're supposed to be doing. It sounds like they're winging it." It turns out that the COVID-19 Delta variant is so dangerous, health officials recommended that even vaccinated people need to wear a mask indoors, as vaccinated people can transmit the virus and become infected, just as unvaccinated people can. Such so-called breakthrough cases are rare, however, and the likelihood of getting seriously ill is much lower among those who have been vaccinated. Durham's new mask mandate went into effect on Monday. At a press conference announcing the new rule, Steve Shule, the mayor, said he felt he had to reinstate and will reevaluate its necessity every week. While Shule acknowledged that there have been a small number of breakthrough cases, he called the pandemic that we are experiencing now, quote, "a pandemic of the unvaccinated," and said if you are unvaccinated, the chances are good the virus will find you. The new mandate comes as intensive care units in Triangle hospitals are reaching capacity, with waiting rooms overflowing with patients. And while Wake County has required that people wear masks inside county buildings, it hasn't taken the farther step of requiring an indoor mask mandate across the board. Though the county has seen more than 4,000 new cases of COVID over the past 2 weeks and has one of the highest case rates in the state. Dara Demi, the county's communications director, told Indy on Monday that she is currently not aware of any plans to reinstate a mask mandate like Durham's. in the face of a COVID variant that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, described in an internal report as being as contagious as chickenpox. Durham County health officials reported a decline in vaccinations since June, when the number of fully vaccinated residents increased by about 8.5% over the previous month. During May, the number of fully vaccinated residents grew by some 15%. The drop was even more dramatic in July, when the number of fully vaccinated residents grew by less than 2%. Durham County health officials reported a 3% increase in COVID cases between July 1 and July 26, according to the latest available data on its website. In Wake, the number of cases has grown by more than 6% since July 1. Durham's state of emergency is in concert with the NC Department of Health and Human Services and the CDC's call for all people, including those who are vaccinated, to wear masks in indoor spaces when they are around people they do not live with, in order to reduce the spread. The Bull City's new state of emergency comes a little over a week after Governor Roy Cooper allowed the state's mask restrictions to end on July 30. But Cooper, as with several governors across the country, urged residents to follow updated CDC guidelines about wearing masks inside. COVID-19 metrics from the last 14 days show Durham reported 264 cases per 100,000 residents and 241 COVID deaths. 174,000 people, or about 54% of the population, are fully vaccinated as of Monday. Wake County reported 459 cases per 100,000 and 752 deaths, and about 55% of the population fully vaccinated. Orange County, where COVID spread is moderate compared to Durham and Wake, reported 230 cases per 100,000 and 101 deaths. The county has a vaccination rate of 60.9%. Now, I'm turning to the online Indie Week, which has articles more recently as yesterday's publication date. This is a report by Jane Porter. File this under that simmering sense of dread you feel about thousands of college students returning to your city this week to start in-person classes. According to the College Resources site, School Authority, which accesses and aggregates geo-tagged Twitter data, North Carolina is the number two state in the nation where Twitter users have shown interest in obtaining fake COVID proof of vaccination cards. The number one state, that honor goes to Texas. School Authority tracked more than 130,000 tweets, hashtags, and direct keyword phrases about fake vaccination cards, such as fake vaccine card, fake COVID card, buy fake vaccine card, to create a map. And that map is pictured in this online article to show which states have reflected the most interest. School Authority started tracking interest in the fake vaccine cards after the website researched states with the most colleges and universities which require vaccinations. In North Carolina, only private universities can legally require students and faculties to get the vaccine. UNC system schools, including Chapel Hill, will require a system of voluntary reporting, and absent that, a weekly testing requirement. Local businesses have already announced requirements for proof of vaccination, and reports of college students trying to buy fake vaccination cards have been circulating in the last week. UNC Chapel Hill has already identified a cluster of six COVID cases related to a, quote, event in the Eshelman School of Pharmacy. Move-in starts Thursday, that's today, for thousands of students, and classes begin next Wednesday. In a meeting today with Chancellor Kevin Guskiewicz, faculty members called on the university to require the vaccine for returning students and staff. Guskiewicz says he agrees with the vaccine mandate, and he and Provost Bob Bluen are working with other chancellors to try to get this mandate in place. Guskiewicz also shared updated COVID numbers. As of Tuesday, 84% of students who will be living and attending classes attest to being vaccinated. About 64% of staff and 92% of faculty members say they are vaccinated, but Guskowitz emphasizes the university has no intention of pivoting to remote learning or sending students home. He acknowledged there will be more clusters and potentially breakthrough cases. Something tells me it's going to be a long fall semester, and it hasn't even started. Well, let's continue. What do you say about COVID-19? Lee Toss reports about the triangle. A perfect storm. Teaching middle schoolers how to play trombone and flute has never been easy, but for Wake County music teacher Patricia Norris, who asked us not to use her real name for fear of backlash, the job has never been harder. When the COVID pandemic hit its peak early this year, on-site students had to wear special face masks and protective bell covers to limit the airflow from their instruments. Daily playing time was limited to 30 minutes. Even more challenging, most students were participating virtually, so hands-on instruction was almost impossible. Is it annoying? Yes, Norris tells me. Am I willing to put up with that annoyance? 1,000 times yes. Well, Norris is vaccinated. Her husband is immunocompromised and unable to get the vaccine without potential health risks. And now that a new, even more contagious strain of the virus known as the Delta variant is infecting thousands in North Carolina, she's fearful of bringing COVID home. That's why, despite the nuisance, Norris is willing to jump over hurdles to keep her family safe while ensuring her students still get as much quality instruction as possible. She's far from alone. Teachers and school staff statewide, from primary school to the state's university system, are wary as the new semester quickly approaches and share the concern that the administration isn't doing enough to keep them safe in the classroom. UNC Chapel Hill office worker Michelle Clark, who is also asked we not use her real name for fear of retaliation, has been back in her cubicle for 3 weeks now and keeps her mask on at all times. While vaccinated, she is a high-risk individual, as is her mother. Though the school has rolled out some protocols, including mandating the use of masks inside all campus buildings, Clark feels they aren't enough to stop a potential outbreak once students return. For starters, teachers learned this week that desks in their classroom were rearranged to pre-pandemic form without any social distancing. But many are afraid to voice these concerns for fear of putting their jobs at risk. Clark told the Indy, "I don't feel safe, and I think there are a lot of people that are uncomfortable, but it's all said in one-on-one conversations, not in a group setting. I think everyone is a little wary about saying too much, and everyone's just waiting for the other shoe to drop. Students come back in a week, and we have been there for 3 weeks now. It feels really tense." A spokesperson for UNC told Indy via email that unvaccinated employees will be required to be tested weekly for the virus. However, the university can't make vaccinations mandatory, as the UNC system, quote, has advised the campuses that under state law, only the North Carolina Commission for Public Health may mandate immunizations for college students. Clark feels the school has been downplaying the risk of the virus, noting that in a recent faculty meeting, the risk of contracting COVID-19 was compared to the likelihood of getting into a car accident on the way to work. Clark said, "I was blown away that those who were being compared and that it was being considered a hazard on the job. It feels like UNC really doesn't care if we get it or not, as long as students are on campus." UNC and NC State University attempted to hold in-person classes last fall, which ended disastrously, with students reportedly partying off campus and a slew of outbreaks reported within days of students' return. Instruction was abruptly shifted online. Without stricter protocols, Clark's staff at the school are wary of another looming catastrophe. Cases of the virus have been creeping up for a while, but within the last 2 weeks, a trickle of positive cases has turned into a flood thanks to Delta. Friday saw the highest number of new cases, 4,500 since this winter, and nearly 11% of folks are testing positive. Hospitalization approaches 2,000, and almost 14,000 people have died from the virus in North Carolina. Meanwhile, 38% of the state remains completely unvaccinated. Governor Roy Cooper recently required state employees to show proof of vaccination, and those who remain unvaccinated will be required to wear masks and get tested regularly. And he said at a press conference, "Until more people get the vaccine, we will continue living with the very real threat of serious disease, and we will continue to see more dangerous and contagious variants like Delta." To the governor's credit, he's done a lot to try to urge the state's anti-vaxxers to get their shots, including holding 4 $1 million lottery drawings, but the vaccination rate has leveled out at fewer than 100,000 new doses per week, which isn't enough to stop the spread of this new strain. Despite the state's alarming metrics, Cooper has yet to reinstitute a statewide mask mandate or require more restrictions in the classroom, such as social distancing protocols, to keep students and teachers safe. Safety standards have been left up to the purview of the school districts. Last week, the Wake County School Board voted to keep its mask mandate in place amid forceful debate from parents and staff on both sides of the issue. Dueling petitions urged the board in different directions, with one asking that masks be optional, while another requested they be required. Statements from some of the state's congressional delegation haven't helped the debate, with Representative Madison Cawthorn fueling the anti-vaxxer sentiments by calling child mask requirements psychological child abuse in a recent interview. Parents have questioned the science behind masks, with little of their own science to back up their claims. Duke professor of pediatrics Danny Benjamin said the science is clear. At a media briefing last week, "From a medicine perspective, masking clearly works. It prevents transmission in schools." As children under 12 can't receive the vaccine, Benjamin said universal mask mandates are the only way to avoid outbreaks. Until a greater percentage of the population has been vaccinated, Benjamin suspects the school will likely, quote, "struggle a little bit with some increased clusters and some secondary transmission this semester." He goes on, "The Delta variant is several fold more transmissible than the original variant, the Alpha. As such, it will make secondary attack rates in the unmasked setting much higher. It will result in much more quarantine and result in faster school closures as a result of multiple clusters. So it makes masking more important." Norris says that at points last semester, her school had only a third of its typical 1,000 students attending class in person. Now 900, about triple, are expected to return, making social distancing that much harder, especially during lunchtime when students typically sit closely talking with masks off while they eat. Norris says the problem is a lack of staffing and funding. Stricter social distance protocols require more teachers to enforce them and more classroom space to spread out students. That just doesn't exist right now. Norris says it's kind of like rearranging the furniture when the house is on fire. "None of us feel quite ready to tackle this beast again, but here we go again, whether we're ready or not." Without addressing gaps in education funding, Norris says teachers will continue to be asked to do more with less. Clark believes vaccination requirements should be in place for all school employees. She's already heard of students buying forged vaccine status cards to bypass protocols. Although weekly testing is in place because faculty have been on campus for weeks, if something is percolating, she says it's already here. And if the past is any precedent, she doubts the university will take further action to stop the spread until it's too late. "Everything is so reactive, it's reckless." Norris said she hoped the Wake County School Board would fully return before the new semester begins to the social distancing standards put into place last year. While the mask mandate was a good start, she says more is needed to keep teachers and their families safe. She says doing it this time around is going to be this much more difficult because we have so many more bodies on our campuses. I know there are huge roadblocks to that. You would need more staff. More staff means more money. It's a perfect storm. Now from Joe Killian, an article called Witch Hunt. A UNC Chapel Hill investigation into a leaked donor agreement is focusing on professors who have been critical of Walter Hussman, the wealthy Arkansas media magnate whose $25 million pledge to the university's journalism school led to its being renamed for him. It also includes the university's examining faculty emails without their knowledge, according to sources directly involved in the investigation. Last week, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, known as FIRE, F-I-R-E, sent a letter to Chancellor Kevin Guskowitz warning the investigation appears to be violating the First Amendment rights of faculty. Hussman's behind-the-scenes lobbying against the hiring of acclaimed journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones drew new attention to his influence at the university and was a major factor in Hannah-Jones refusing an eventual tenure offer from the school and instead going to Howard University. The contract with Hussman, which the university considers confidential, was published by the News and Observer on July 14th. The university announced an investigation 2 days later seeking to determine how the paper got the document. So far, say two professors the university has attempted to interview as part of the inquiry, the school appears to be focusing not on those who may have had access to the documents, but on professors who have been publicly critical of Hussman's outsized influence. Deb Acat and Daniel Kreis, both professors at the Hussman School of Journalism and Media, were asked to answer questions about the leak of the document. But both professors say their positions wouldn't have given them access to the contract, and that the university appears to have singled them out because of their criticism of Hussman. Acat met with investigators this week. Kreis declined to do so, he said Wednesday, amid concerns about how it was being handled and by whom. I did agree to the meeting, Kreis said. However, over the weekend, the more I thought about it and talked to other university leaders, including consulting with a few people who specialize in employment law, questions that came up over and over again were, under what authority is this inquiry happening? What are my rights and responsibilities, and what is the scope? Kreis asked those questions of Katie Nolan, Executive Director of Strategy, Policy, and Special Projects at UNC's Division of Human Resource and Equal Opportunity and Compliance, who had asked to speak with him as part of the investigation. In an email, Nolan replied that she was, quote, not proceeding under any specific formal policy or process at this time, as leadership doesn't have enough information at this time to determine whether a policy or process has potentially been violated. Nolan had been asked to help in that assessment, she wrote to Kreis. Kreis said, this raised a million red flags to me. There's no formal policy. There's no formal process. As I'm sure you can appreciate, I was very wary of walking into a meeting where someone who is a lawyer with people who are far senior to me are going to ask me questions in a meeting with no rules, that doesn't concern any specific policies they can name, and is not taking place according to any university-determined process. I felt like that would make me really vulnerable and make other UNC employees potentially very vulnerable, even though I don't have any privileged knowledge relating to this inquiry. That, say both Kreis and Acat, appears to be the point. To send a message to vocal faculty that speech critical of the university or its major donors makes them de facto suspects. Acat told Policy Watch on Wednesday, there's no reason to believe that anyone on the faculty would have had access to the things they are talking about. But if you look at the people they have asked to speak to, who they want to ask questions, it is the people who have spoken out on Walter Hussman and the influence that it is obvious he had in the Nicole Hannah-Jones hiring. Two sources with direct knowledge of the investigation told Policy Watch that the university has also access to the emails of faculty they suspect may have had knowledge of how the document was leaked, and is preparing evidence from those emails with which to confront them in interviews. Let's see. One of the sources who asked not to be identified in order to avoid retaliation said, absent anyone saying there has been specific misconduct by these individuals that is being investigated, that is a total violation. People use their university emails to discuss private information from students, medical information, private family information with their families. For the university to be accessing these emails without any warning to faculty and without citing any evidence that any of these individuals have done anything or are suspected of doing anything wrong is completely outside of established university procedures and completely unethical. In its Wednesday letter to the school's chancellor, FIRE called the targeting of faculty a potential First Amendment violation, and it wrote in its letter to the chancellor, there is nothing, including in their criticism itself, to indicate that their criticism was based on access to confidential information not already obtained by the media and their own experiences at faculty in the Hussman School. Thus, we are concerned that the course of UNC's investigation as it pertains to faculty members such as Kreis and Aycott owes its origin to their exercise of protected speech in public criticism of UNC and Walter Hussman, not whether they had access to the agreement. The group wrote, comments Kreis and Aycott have made on social media and to reporters are protected by the First Amendment. As state employees, professors do not relinquish First Amendment rights to comment on matters of public interest by virtue of government employment. Rather, the right of government employees to speak as individuals on matters of public concern is clearly preserved in First Amendment jurisprudence. In fact, courts recognize faculty rights to free expression as uniquely robust in order to preserve academic freedom and the university's important role as the quintessential marketplace of ideas. The letter continued, precedent is clear that an investigation targeting individuals who have exercised First Amendment rights can itself violate the First Amendment, even if the investigation concludes in favor of the speakers. The question is not whether the university ultimately metes out formal punishment, but whether the institution actions would chill or silence a person of ordinary firmness from future First Amendment activities. An investigation into protected expression may meet this standards, and the group has requested a reply from the university. Policy Watch has reached out to the administrators conducting the investigation. They forwarded the request to university spokesperson Joanne Peters-Denny, who provided the following statement, quote, many of our employees are entrusted with confidential information pursuant to various state and federal laws and contractual agreements. When that confidentiality is breached, we take it very seriously. As the university previously indicated, we are investigating reports of a leak of confidential donor information related to the agreement between the Hussman family, the university, and the then School of Media and Journalism. We are unable to comment further at this time. Kreis said Wednesday, the university is wasting its time with such an investigation. It would make more sense to look into the undue influence Hussman wielded during this controversy surrounding the job and tenure offers extended to Hannah Jones. Last week, that influence was revealed to be even broader than previously believed when the university released hundreds of pages of documents and emails related to the controversy in a reply to outstanding requests under the Freedom of Information Act. The emails showed Hussman contacting more people than he initially disclosed, more times than he admitted in interviews on the matter, and having far greater access to confidential personnel information related to the hire than is generally given to anyone outside the actual hiring process. Kreis said they should be looking into that. The university has, so far, announced no such investigation. All right, Tomasi McDonald from Durham, making good. When the William T. Grant Foundation announced last month that it had awarded a $300,000 grant to the Samuel Dubois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University to research the feasibility of paying reparations to Black American descendants of enslaved persons, William Darity Jr. was elated. Darity, a Duke economist who will lead the research project, told Indy that the commitment of a major philanthropist to support such research was a signal moment. As director of the Cook Center, he is widely considered one of the nation's leading scholars on the issue of reparations. And he wrote in an email to the Indy, "This is unprecedented and very encouraging." The project was called Making Black Reparations in America. Dating back to Union General William T. Sherman's Special Field Orders No. 15 in 1865, which authorized confiscated land and land abandoned by Confederates to be redistributed to freedmen, there have been discussions surrounding reparations as an ultimate acknowledgement of slavery and how the savage, arrogant, and barbaric crime enriched white men and turned America into a superpower. But a legacy of vociferous and negative responses to black reparations has resulted, Darity told the Indy. The fact is that the claim for redress for black American descendants of persons enslaved in the United States has not been met for 156 years. The failure to provide the formerly enslaved with the promised 40-acre land grants at the end of the Civil War suggests that anti-racism must lie at the heart of the persistent resistance to meet the reparations bill. The bill Darity refers to is U.S. House Bill 40, which calls for a commission on the study of reparations. Michigan Democrat John Conyers first introduced it in 1989, and Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, a Democrat from Texas, has been pushing it recently. The bill has never reached the House floor for a vote, however. But the Grant Foundation financed project comes, according to the press release, amid increased interest in reparations as a mechanism to reduce racial inequality. While polls in recent years have shown that most Americans oppose cash reparations, support is trending upward. Foundation officials noted that more than half Americans would favor a congressional commission to study the legacy of slavery and ongoing systemic racism directed at black Americans. That sustained anti-black racism is a consequence of the nation's failure to hold slave-holding secessionists accountable by treating the Confederate War on the Union as an act of treason, Darity says. He connects the Confederacy to the attempted coup in the nation's capital on January 6th as running, quote, in a straight line. While the Foundation noted in the release the full toll of slavery was immeasurable, officials point to one metric as proof of the fallout, the racial wealth gap. Black Americans account for nearly 13% of the nation's population, but they hold less than 3% of the nation's wealth. Moreover, the average level of black family wealth is $850,000 less than that of the average white family, Darity says. Foundation officials say the wealth gap serves as a critical index of the cumulative effects across generations of racial injustice in the United States. Quote, research is clear that the disadvantages faced by black children and youth substantially reflect the unequal transmission of wealth across generations, which is rooted in slavery and continues through systemic racism into our own day, says Foundation President Adam Gamoran. Reparations to descendants of enslaved persons has the potential to address the structural foundations of racial inequality and is a potential national policy. It calls for rigorous scientific inquiry to address questions of feasibility and practicality. Darity says grassroots activism has aided growing interest and support for reparations. Receptiveness among several 2020 presidential candidates and the events of 2020, particularly the murder of George Floyd, quote, led finally to widespread acknowledgement that there is systemic and continuous anti-black violence in the United States. Darity and Duke economist Lisa Janishian will be joined by a team of researchers who will conduct a series of macro simulation exercises to investigate the effects of different configurations of black reparations, to gauge the impact on the economic well-being of black children and their families, but also the economy-wide ramifications for all Americans. Foundation officials say the scientific work includes 4 engagement activities that will enable the team to share their findings with research audiences and the broader public. Darity says the simulation exercises are an important part of the research supported by the grant, but can't yet share them publicly. In the book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 20th Century, Darity and co-author A. Kirsten Mullen propose a range of payment options to eliminate the racial wealth gap based on unpaid wages, the purchase prices of human property, and the land promised to the freedmen. The book points to the words of Judah P. Benjamin, a member of Jefferson Davis's Confederate cabinet, who in 1860 said, quote, "Our slaves directly or indirectly involve a value of $4,000 million. Darity and Mullen points out in From Here to Equality that as of 2019, $4 billion compounds at 4% interest to $2 trillion. At 5% interest, $9 trillion. And at 6% interest, $42 trillion. A reparations program based on the broken promise of 40 acres of tillable ground could result in financial payments of $267,000 per person for 40 million black descendants of American slavery. The literal promised land for freedmen covered 3 states that stretched across the coast of South Carolina and extended down through Georgia into the northern portions of Florida. For black Americans, it was yet another promise unkept. Following the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, President Andrew Johnson ordered the land allocated under Special Field Orders No. 15 to be restored to the former slaveholders. During a June appearance on CBS Sunday Morning, Darity noted that it would cost $11 to $12 trillion to finance reparations, more than twice the federal budget. CBS Sunday journalist Mark Whitaker noted. Whitaker also pointed to a University of Massachusetts Amherst WCVB poll in the spring that indicated 2/3 of Americans are against government reparation. Undeterred, Darity points to one of the hypotheses of his research into the feasibility of paying reparations to black Americans. Quote, if a reparations plan closed the black-white wealth gap, it would contribute to a higher rate of growth for the U.S. economy as a whole. Now, from Elizabeth Thompson, originally published by NC Health News, A Hard Bargain. A bill that would make post-exposure prophylaxis, PEP, birth control, and testosterone more easily available is on Governor Roy Cooper's desk. But while some advocates celebrate the bill's passage, opponents argue against controversial vaccine language added to the bill. The bill came into controversy after Senator Joyce Krawiec's a Republican from Forsyth, added a provision requiring young people to get parental permission before receiving the vaccines that have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration, such as the COVID-19 vaccine. The House passed that bill Thursday, 106-5, with 5 Democrats voting no after the Senate gave it unanimous approval on Tuesday. House Bill 96 would allow pharmacists to dispense, deliver, and administer certain medications, including PEP, nicotine replacement therapy, self-administered oral and transdermal contraceptives, prenatal vitamins, glucagon, testosterone, and vitamin B12, as well as vaccinations or immunizations, quote, recommended or required by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says the bill. The bill also requires health care providers to, quote, obtain written consent from a parent or legal guardian prior to administering any vaccine that has been granted emergency use authorization and is not yet fully approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to an individual under 18 years of age. This would include all current vaccinations against COVID-19, although the FDA has accelerated its timetable to approve the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine by Labor Day or sooner. Krawitz said the amendment was in response to her constituents' concerns about their children receiving a vaccine approved for emergency use authorization. "Parents know their children the best," she said in a news release Tuesday. "They, not the government, should have the ultimate say when it comes to their child's health." Representative Pricey Harrison, Democrat of Guilford, who is an original sponsor of the bill, removed her name from the bill and voted against it due to that amendment. She did not speak on the House floor Thursday since she may have been exposed to coronavirus recently. She told WRAL, "I don't think it's a good idea. There are a lot of vaccine skeptics out there. My opinion is we need more people vaccinated, not fewer." Representative Wayne Sasser, Republican of Albemarle, primary sponsor of the bill, said it had no opposition on the House floor Thursday. "We've worked with some changes that they made over in the Senate," Sasser said. "All the stakeholders are on board." Lee Starrow, executive director of the North Carolina AIDS Action Network, said the bill's passage is a move in the right direction in expanding access to PEP, an oral medication one must take 72 hours after possible exposure to an HIV-positive person in order to prevent HIV. Starrow said people who need PEP prophylaxis are finding themselves in an emergency situation and they need to get access to the medication in up to 72 hours. There's strong agreement from even medical providers that pharmacists need to be able to dispense this medication to folks. If the bill is signed into law, North Carolina would join states like New York, California, Colorado, and Virginia in making this medication more available. Starrow said there's a real desire in the public health space and for those of us working in HIV, hepatitis C, and communicable diseases to make sure that we learn lessons from these last 2 years. He said it's important to grab the initiative so, quote, "we don't find ourselves in a worse place with so many other public health issues after these last 2 years because we've taken our eye off the ball of important priorities around HIV. The bill would also allow pharmacists to administer testosterone injections to people 18 and older and deliver, distribute, and administer birth control. Susanna Birdsong, Director of Public Affairs for Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, said it would be great if the bill also had provisions to help people better afford birth control. But, she said, this is a good first step. And it definitely increases availability and access, and it provides another way, another outlet for people to access birth control. Despite being home to research giants Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill, North Carolina ranked 33rd in America's health rankings by the United Health Federation, Foundation. While every North Carolina county has at least one pharmacy, said Senator Jim Bergen, Republican of Harnett, on the Senate floor, there are 5 counties without a family physician, 20 without a pediatrician, 26 without an OB-GYN, and 30 without a psychiatrist. And Bergen said, House Bill 96 is a combination of multiple groups that came together to help expand access to health care for citizens across our state. And he included the NC Association of Pharmacists, Retail Merchants, Medical Society, and the Medical Board, North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians, Pediatric Society, Obstetrical and Gynecological Society, and Psychiatric Associations. The bill was presented to Cooper Tuesday after the Indy's deadline for this issue. He would not say whether he would sign the bill at a coronavirus task force briefing on August the 4th. Well, that's already taken place. During a tour of the Forsyth Department of Public Health vaccination site, Cooper said, "The language of the amended bill concerns me," reported the Winston-Salem Journal. "We're going to examine that legislation as it goes through the process. It does some important things that we know we need to do, so we're going to continue to look at it." Okay, I believe I have time to read this article from the literary section of Indie Week, and it's written by Rachel Simon. And It's called An Open Book. Now, sharing space with So-and-So Books, the Redbud Writing Project looks towards building out the Triangle's literary scene. For readers and writers alike, the Triangle has always had much to offer. A multitude of beloved bookstores, residents like Lee Smith and the late Randall Keenan, the North Carolina Book Festival, and even a few streets in Raleigh's Quail Hollow, named after writers like Thoreau and Hemingway. But for all its merits, the area has historically lacked a space dedicated to its literary-minded folks until recently. In June, Raleigh's So-and-So Books teamed up with Redbud Writing Project, a writing school serving adults in the Triangle, to open a headquarters for both companies that would bring together the people who write books and those who love to read them. While Redbud's co-founders Emily Cataneo and Arshia Simkin had envisioned a physical hub for the organization since its 2019 launch, it wasn't until So-and-So's co-founder, Chris Tonelli and Charles Wilkes, left the shop's longtime Mordecai location last week in search of a larger space that the possibility of collaborating took shape. Tonelli recalls thinking, "The Triangle area is rich with writers, but there's not a unified scene the way I see in other cities, and I think some part of that is a storefront or a place to go." So when an opportunity arose to partner with another organization to share rent on a new location at 719 North Person Street, Redbud immediately sprang to mind. The space Tonelli and Wilkes landed upon, just across the street from their previous location, features two floors, each with its unique layout. Upstairs, customers can browse So-and-So's endless rows of bright colored shelves before following the staircase down to enter Redbud's offices with their brick-covered walls and hand-carved wooden tables. The two spaces have separate entrances with Redbud's just around the corner from the bookstore, making it ideal for both individual and joint activities. Tonelli says it made a lot of sense to try to develop a kind of center where folks know they can go for books, and they can go for writing, they can go for readings and panels and other literary discussions. For Cataneo and Simkin, partnering with the So-and-So team was an easy decision. Simkin said, "So-and-So is one of the places that has been a champion of Redbud since the beginning." She noted the bookstore's long-held support of its classes and program. When they mentioned they had this opportunity, it kind of seemed too good to pass up. After all, So-and-So isn't just any bookstore. Founded in 2013, the shop specializes in giving customized book recommendations to each potential buyer, along with hosting a number of readings, book clubs, and listening parties, among other events. Tonelli and Wilkes frequently collaborate with other local businesses. Currently, they're partnering with Oakwood Cemetery and NC State's MFA and Creative Writing Program for a poetry contest, with submissions open until September 1. So-and-So's model of community reach-out and non-traditional programming fits well with Redbud's philosophy. Although the school had long held its courses at bookstores around the Triangle, places like Quail Ridge and Chapel Hill's Epilogue, and continues to do so, as well as online, the new headquarters offers a chance for it to expand its offerings through events like readings and trivia nights. Already the locale has been put to good use. Besides the packed grand opening party the organizations hosted on June 25, the space has held writing classes, meetups, and even a pop-up plant shop from local company Philo and Fern. When they're not teaching, both Simkin and Cataneo even take on a few shifts at So-and-So, selling books and encouraging writing-curious customers to check out the organization based just down the stairs. Tonelli says, "The goal is to unify the community so that it's not about separate little pods. It's really great to be in the shop or in a book club or at a reading, and they're talking about Redbud. It just kind of means those things are becoming synonymous, and the barriers to those communities are easing even faster." While Redbud isn't the first Triangle-based organization interested in offering writing workshops in a communal space, Tonelli himself took part in a short-lived endeavor called The Hinge in Durham back in 2011. there's reason to think it'll thrive when its predecessors have failed. For one thing, Simkin and Cataneo are determined to reach students from all areas of the Triangle, not just Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill. And with the Mordecai location as home base, Cataneo says she and Simkin can focus on furthering the school's reach to areas like Pittsboro, where through the town's McIntyre's books, Redbud will be offering its first class later this month. Cataneo says it's really important to us to continue to offer classes throughout the Triangle so we can reach people in all parts of the community, but then we're also really, really excited to have this headquarters. Having brick and mortar literary spaces like this are super important in engendering growth and community in a literary scene in a city. For its fall course load, Redbud is offering 6 workshop classes at its headquarters, in addition to several more at Quail Ridge in Pittsboro and on Zoom. Among other offerings, students can enjoy an introductory novel writing course, an explainer on memoir, and a class entirely focused on surrealism and poetry. Each class will see participants not only learn the craft in question, but also work on projects of their own to share with classmates. Registration is open now. The first courses begin August the 15th. Donnelly is hopeful that Redbud students will check out so-and-so's offerings upstairs before and after each session. So I will have to curtail this account about so-and-so and the Redbud Writing Project, which can be found, though, on more of details on IndieWeek.com. I'm John Federson, and this issue of Indie Week will be contained for a week in our podcast section of the website, ncreadingservice.org. And there's also back issues that stretch back years of Indie Week, formerly known as The Independent. And you can give those a look at just any old time. And I will be back next week, I believe, with our next weekly issue, this tabloid, The Indie Week. John Federson, then, for ncreadingservice.org, saying so long.